Yeah, I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for giving me the chance to present my work here. I'm going to talk about a supersymmetric model for lattice fermions, which was the topic for my PhD research, and I continued to work on that with various people over the last year. And so first, I'd like to say that it's not like directly applicable to the workshop topic of holography. I won't be talking about holography at all, but I think there's still some interesting connections here. The spirit is somewhat similar for the motivation for this work, but more importantly, there's some features that really resemble features that are seen in holography. So it would be nice if at some point some real connection could be made. So before I start, I'd like to thank my supervisor back in Amsterdam, Karel-Jan Schoutens, and his longtime collaborator Paul Fentley, with whom he wrote down the model. I'll mostly talk about work with Beda Bauer, who's here, and Eric Berg.
There are three different
DVDs. No, sorry, they're this is the most important thing, so it's a big A. So as we've all heard, there's a big challenge in condensed matter physics related to strongly interacting electron systems, and some key examples of those are the high-TC superconductors and the heavy fermion compounds, which they're well studied in experimental setups, and they show all kinds of unconventional things that the theory we have currently available in condensed matter physics doesn't seem to capture very well. And so this is the motivation for the work I'll talk about, and I'll discuss it. I'll come back to what these techniques are that don't work in a moment. But so the main, or sort of the standard approach in condensed matter theory is to consider your solid as a crystal, where the ions crystallize and they form a background potential for your valence electrons. And then you write some lattice model where these valence electrons can hop around in this periodic potential. And the Hamiltonian is then typically the sum of kinetic terms, nearest neighbor hopping, for example, and short-range repulsive interactions. And the paradigm model for strongly interacting electrons is the Hubbard model, which looks as follows. So there's a nearest neighbor hopping for spinful electrons, so sigma is the spin index, it's here. And then there's an energy penalty for two of these electrons to sit on the same side. So to be able to sit on the same side, they of course have to have opposite spin. Even though this model is extremely simple, it already gives rise to sort of interesting phase diagram. So there's basically two limits that are well understood. In one limit, where you have very low densities of electrons, the electrons are far apart, and so you can neglect the interactions, and it's dominated by the kinetics. And in that case, it forms a Fermi liquid, a conducting phase. And at the other end, when you're at very high densities, everything's dominated by the interactions, and you get the famous mod insulating phase. And this sort of schematic phase diagram shows some remarkable similarities with the cuprates, but to understand if really this model captures all the fun physics that's going on in the cuprates, we have to understand this intermediate density regime, where both the kinetics as well as the interactions play important roles. And that's a huge challenge. And so in this regime, in this intermediate density regime, the conventional techniques fail. So mean field results are unreliable. Beta ansatz, which is a very powerful technique in one dimension, doesn't work for higher dimensions. And quantum Monte Carlo, which is a computational technique that's really powerful for bosons, for fermions suffers from the sign problem. So that also has difficulties discussing this problem. And of course, this is an extremely difficult problem, and by no means do I want to pretend that I have anything to say about this in the rest of the talk. But I just want to use this as motivation. I think it justifies the sort of extreme approach that I'm going to take. I'm going to make some huge simplifications, but the difficulty of the problem, I hope I've conveyed that justifies this approach. So what will I do? I'll make some drastic simplifications and adjustments, and I'll also do some fine-tuning. But the upshot of this approach is that we will be able to present exact results for strongly interacting fermions in one dimension, but also in higher dimensions. And these are really results that are not accessible via these conventional techniques. Okay, so the model I'll be discussing is for spinless fermions. So that's the first simplification. I'm going to drop the spin. And so spinless fermions, due to Pauli exclusion, are forbidden to sit on the same side. And furthermore, they'll be hardcore, by which I mean that they're forbidden to occupy neighboring sites. So you can think of this as having a nearest neighbor repulsion, V1, that's infinite. And then there will be a nearest neighbor hopping, which respects this hardcore constraint. So then hopping like this is not allowed. Okay, so just very naively, we get a phase diagram that looks like this. So again, at low densities, the interactions will play no role, and we'll get a Fermi liquid-like phase again. And at very high densities, you get some sort of trivial insulator, where just all the particles are blocked because of this hardcore constraint. And some work by Handy and others has shown that upon small doping of this model, you get a strike phase. And so, again, it's a very simple model, but it already has some nice features in it. And now what I'll be discussing in this talk is that we can access the intermediate density regime of this model by incorporating supersymmetry. And that was first introduced by Bentley and Schoutens in the book. Okay, so what I'd like to convey to you in this talk is that the benefit of supersymmetry will be twofold. On the one hand, it will allow us or hand us some really powerful tools. And on the other hand, it will induce some subtle interplay between the kinetics and the interactions, which gives rise to interesting physics. So the features of the model are also sort of enhanced by the supersymmetry. And so I'll just start by defining the model with supersymmetry and discuss some basics of supersymmetry. And then there's three parts that I want to talk about. I'd like to tell you about superfrustration, which is a typical feature that we observe in these models, which is characterized by an extensive ground state entropy. It's something that you should like. And the other thing I want to talk about is that we observe quantum criticality, but this will be in 1+1 dimensions. I'll call that 1D, actually. So if I say 1D, then I mean 1+1. And then finally, I want to go back to 2D, where we can say something about quantum ground states as tilings, and there'll be a relation also to topological phases. Right, so supersymmetry, we work on the lattice, so we have quantum mechanical supersymmetry, and it's basically an algebraic structure, and it's defined using the following operators. So we have two supercharges, 2 plus and 2 minus, which square to 0. 2 minus is the Hermitian conjugate of 2 plus. And there will be a fermion number operator, nf, which has this commutation relation with the supercharges, which means that 2 plus effectively adds a fermion if 3 of freedom to the system, and Q minus takes out the fermionic degree of freedom from the system. And then given these operators, we define the Hamiltonian as the anticommutator of Q plus and Q minus. And then it immediately follows that the Hamiltonian will commute with all three of these operators. Now, imposing this structure has some immediate consequences for the spectrum. So first of all the spectrum is positive definite, so there are no negative energy states. And furthermore, all the states with a positive energy and non-zero energy will pair into doublets, and they can be written using this representation. So if you have a state psi that's annihilated by Q minus, then there will be a state Q plus psi which has the same energy as the state psi. And finally, a state has zero energy if and only if it's annihilated by both Q plus and Q minus. Now, in high-energy physics, supersymmetry is usually a symmetry between bosonic and fermionic particles, but it's important to realize here that the only particles that we have are these spinless fermions that I introduced a couple of slides ago. So there are no bosons, but the symmetry instead is now between many-body states, and a many-body state can be bosonic when there's an even number of fermions, and fermionic when there's an odd number of fermions. Okay, so this was just the supersymmetry structure. Now we have to make this into a lattice model, so we have to define what these supercharges are. And what we choose them to be is as follows. So Q plus will be the sum over all lattice sites of this creation operator of a spinless fermion, Ci Dagger, times a projection operator, which is zero if a site neighboring the site where you want to create the particle is already occupied. So it's so that gives you this nearest neighbor constraint. Q minus is the Hermitian conjugate of this, and Mj is just the number of operators. So Mj is one when there's a fermion sitting on site J, and zero otherwise. Okay, so using this definition, we can then work out this anticommutator. And what you find if you were to do, so now you have to choose a lattice if you want to work this out. And as an example, I chose here a one-dimensional chain, a periodic chain of sites. And then what you find is that the Hamiltonian turns out to look like this. So it has a nearest neighbor hopping for these hardcore fermions. And there's a potential term, so there's an energy penalty for particles to be next to nearest neighbors. There's a chemical potential term, and there's a constant. So the L is the length of the chain, and NF is the particle number operator.
Chain is closed. Chain is closed?
This is for periodic chain, yes. And so you see that but this gives something reasonable, right? We have just nearest neighbor hopping, so that's nice. There's no long range hopping, and also the interactions are short range. The only thing is that all the parameters in the Hamiltonian are already fixed by demanding supersymmetry. So there's not much freedom. So the freedom that you have mostly is to change the lattice, and so that's something that I'll be doing throughout the talk a lot.
Isn't it very important to have this projection operators? You could have a Q operator, which is just linear in C and cubic in C, and construct some supersymmetric Hamiltonian and study it, and we'll do more parameters on this.
Yeah. It's very difficult to get something reasonable without this projection operator. But I don't claim at all that I've exhausted all possibilities. So, I mean, there could be something nice using a different construction versus. Right, and so here I wrote what the Hamiltonian looks like for a general lattice. So in that case, you still have just nearest neighbor hopping. So this brackets means that I and J are neighbors. So the hopping is always nearest neighbor. So that's nice. And then But there's, again, a potential term which will depend now, the details depend on the lattice, where I've introduced this projection operator. So let's start with a simple example. So if we have, so this is a six-sided periodic chain, you know, like drawn like this, and let's just consider what the different states are on this chain. So there can be, there's the empty states, there's just one of them, which are denoted like this. So not to be confused with the ground state, I mean, this is just the empty state. And then there are six configurations where I have one particle. There are nine configurations with two particles without violating the nearest neighbor constraint. And then finally, there's two configurations with three particles, and that's it. Because if I want to add a fourth particle, I have to violate this nearest neighbor constraint. So this is the Hilbert space for this system. And then the spectrum looks like this. So here I plot the energy versus the number of particles. And as you can see, it has all the features of supersymmetry that I told you before. So there are no negative energy states. And all the positive energy states are paired into doublets. And they the superpartners differ in their fermion number by one. And what else? Oh, and well, okay. And there are two zero energy states, and those are not pairs, but they don't have to be pairs, they're singles. So these two states are annihilated by both Q plus and Q minus. Okay, so the first and maybe most powerful tool that supersymmetry allows for is the Witten index, and it will lead to this property that I advertised at the start, this super frustration. So let me introduce the Witten index to you. So the Witten index is the trace of minus 1 to the power nf, where nf counts the number of fermions in the system. And it should be clear that the bosonic states will have an even number of fermions, so they contribute the plus 1. And the fermionic state contributes a minus 1. And so as a result of that, all superpartners will cancel, because the superpartners have one bosonic and one fermionic guy. And so the Witten index will be the number of bosonic ground states minus the number of fermionic ground states, where by ground state I mean zero energy state. And so as a consequence, the absolute value of the Witten index is a lower bound to the number of zero energy states. And so in this example, let's see if that works out. So it's just a combinatorial problem. I can just do it in the Hilbert space. I don't have to diagonalize the Hamiltonian or anything. And so I just trace over the Hilbert space of this minus 1 to the nf. So this state will give this giver 1. These six one particle states give a minus 6, plus 9, minus 2, and gives 2, which is the correct result. So that's these.
So in this computation, I don't have to look at the states in the ground state, right? You compute these in the entire Hilbert space.
Right. Yes, the traces over all states in the Hilbert space. That's the power of it. Okay, so. So now, of course, that was easy, so we can do it for a triangular lattice. And this was work done by a student at the University of Amsterdam. So what I show here is a table of the triangular lattice with m by n sides. And as a function of these m by n sides, you see that there's dramatic growth of this lower bounds to the number of zero energy states. So this is just a lower bound. And so if you try to extract how this grows as a function of system size, you find that the absolute value is exponential. The absolute value of the Witten index is this number to the power of the volume of your system. So it's exponential in the number of sides of the system. And the triangular lattice is not the only lattice that shows this behavior. So the hexagonal lattice also has, yeah, so here I L denotes the number of sides in the system. That's maybe slightly confusing notation. So this is really the volume element. And so for the hexagonal lattice, you also see this exponential growth. And for the Martini lattice, we could do even better and compute the exact number of zero energy states, and so extract the ground state entropy. And it's indeed an extensive property of the system. Okay, so.
How big is the cancellation there?
In this case, the Witten index is actually a precise result. There's no cancellation. Yeah. So all the ground states in this case have one particle per triangle. So they have the old same filling, all the same particle number.
So what you need to know in addition to be able to count?
Yes. I'll talk about that in probably 20 minutes. So first, I'm going to talk about something else, but I'll come back to that. Okay, so this is, of course, there's some frustration going on, right? There's lots of ways to realize the ground state. So the key example of a frustrated system is the antiferromagnet on triangular lattice, where this is geometric frustration. So the antiferromagnet wants the spins to be anti-parallel, anti-aligned, and so this third spin doesn't know which bond to satisfy. It has basically two options, and so that leads to a ground state degeneracy. Now, in the case of our system, there's not really geometric frustration, but there's a very subtle interplay between the kinetic and the potential terms that also leads to this frustration, and in our case, exponential a ground state degeneracy. And so that's a violation of the third law of thermodynamics. And a quantitative way of understanding this frustration is from the free rule. So the repulsive interactions, remember that there's a nearest neighbor exclusion, and then there's a next nearest neighbor repulsion. And so those interactions favor the particles to be three sites apart. And then the chemical potential favors high density, so that's actually the optimal. And it turns out that combined with the kinetics, there's a huge possibility to satisfy this free rule. And it also tells you that this charge frustration happens at intermediate densities, right, where the particles are three sites apart, so there's still room for hopping, and so they will. Both the kinetics and the interactions actually play an important role. Oh yeah, and I should just make sure that that you understand that these ground states are really quantum mechanical ground states, right? There's not a simple picture that you can have for what it looks like. It's not ordered, and then lots of ways to order. But they're really, the ground state will be a huge superposition of possible particle configurations.
So this degeneracy is over all number of particles, right? So I mean, by just calculating the Witten index, you cannot tell for which number of particles you get this huge degeneracy.
That's
right. Is there any way of arguing which, and that it's really the higher density states that dominate the degeneracy versus lower density states? I mean, is there any additional intuition that you can get?
So that's case by case. So if you can really compute the total number of ground states, very often you can really know what the ground state degeneracy is at each filling. And so here I haven't really told you about that yet, so I'm just telling you that the degeneracy is at intermediate densities. But we have a lot of evidence for that for various cases. Okay, so now let me talk about quantum criticality in these systems. So for the periodic chain, so periodic boundary conditions with the length L, it turns out that there's two zero energy states when the length is a multiple of 3, and there's one zero energy state otherwise. And so for a moment you can forget about Brown city energy, which is at most two zero energy states. And the filling is the third, so the number of fermions in these ground states is the length divided by 3. And for this model, it turns out that it's integrable, and there's a beta ansatz solution. And the continuum limit, low energy effective theory, is described by an n equals 2,2 superconformal field theory with central charge equal to 1. And so this means that the continuum limit is a CFT, so it's a quantum critical system. And moreover, this supersymmetry that we had on the lattice becomes an emergent spacetime supersymmetry. And so there has been a lot of work on this model. It's really like a textbook example of realizing this superconformal field theory on the lattice. It has its extremely nice properties when you look at it numerically, and there's a lot of understanding. So here I list a couple of papers that discuss this model, but I actually want to focus on a different model, so I'll just make one more slide with advertisement about this chain, which is that there's an exact mapping from this SUSY model on the chain to an XXC spin chain, and where the anisotropy parameter takes a certain value. And so this tells us that there's supersymmetry in the XXC spin chain, but it's actually via this mapping that this was observed, because in the XXC spin chain you don't see it, because the supersymmetry actually relates spin chains of different lengths. So it's sort of a hidden supersymmetry, but it does explain various properties that were observed, like they could exactly know what the value of the ground state was and things like that, and that's strongly related to the fact that there's this hidden supersymmetry. And so that's maybe nice to know that even though we don't see supersymmetry in condensed matter systems, it might be there, but just hidden. And actually, via this mapping, it turns out that there's also a relation to these supersymmetric matrix models that Veneziano and Wozzeck wrote down in the context of string theory. And so they independently found this hidden supersymmetry in the XXC spin chain via their models. But so that may also be a nice route to go from these SUSY models to closer to string theory and make a connection. And then finally, this model can be generalized by generalizing this hardcore constraint and now allowing k particles to be nearest neighbor, but not k plus 1. And so in this case, the spin chain would be the k equals 1 model. But now you have a whole series of models, the MK SUSY models, and there's very compelling evidence that these models realize the kth superconformal or the low energy continuum limit is described by the kth superconformal minimal models. So,
can we say from the molar spin chain? So, like the region we have JX1 and JB.
Yes. So
do you require a certain ratio of JB or JX1 to make super symmetry?
Yes.
So what's the ratio?
So I usually think in delta, so jx, y are 1 and jz is delta, and then delta is minus a half.
And you see?
Yes, only here.
Okay,
so now let me talk about this model, which is not a textbook example. It took us quite a little bit more work to figure out what the continuum theory for this system is, but now we think we understand it, more or less. So these are somewhat preliminary results that I'm showing you. So please take them with a grain of salt if needed. There's again, no huge ground state degeneracy. So in this case, if the length of this ladder is multiple 4, there are 3 zero energy states, and there's 1 zero energy state otherwise. And the number of particles in the ground state is at a quarter filling. So L over 2 gives you one particle every 4 sites. And we seem to have identified the continuum theory to be the second superconforming minimal model. So that has central charge 3/2. And the evidence that we have for this is first of all, that the Witten index for the kth minimal model should go as k plus 1, and k is 2, and so that gives you 3 zero energy states. Other evidence that we have is from spectral flow. You can do a boundary twist of the model and then look at how the energy levels behave as a function of this twist, and that agrees very nicely with what you would expect from superconformal field theory. Then we also have some evidence that the operator content and the entanglement entropy are consistent with this picture, and I'm going to talk about these.
So you keep the things here, they're keeping the L1 form or something?
Yes.
And it's only like 0 mod 4 that gives the.
No, all of them. So in the case of the chain, we understand it really well. So there, the Witten index should be 2, and it is if the length of the chain is multiple of 3. But then it turns out that the cases where the length is multiple of 3 plus or minus 1 are actually twisted sectors. So also those sectors are those cases are completely understood from the field theory. Our understanding in this case is not as good as in the case of the chain, but we probably, I mean, it seems sensible that these other are just twisted sectors. Yeah, and also I should say that the supersymmetry that we have on the lattice forces you to be in the Ramon sector of the theory. So because the NS sector has a negative, right, the energy of the vacuum in the NS sector is minus C over 12 or whatever. And so that's negative, and we don't have that. We have strictly positive definite energy spectrum. And so you can actually go to the NS sector by twisting the boundary. Okay, so this you probably all know, but let me just briefly say what the entanglement entropy is, and then show you that we find this C equals 3/2 from this computation. So the entanglement entropy can be defined if you divide your system into a subsystem A and a subsystem B, and you write the von Neumann entropy minus trace over rho log rho for a subsystem A, where where rho A is the reduced density matrix, which is obtained from the density matrix by tracing out all the degrees of freedom in your system B. And it's well known that for a critical system with a finite length L, the entanglement entropy has scales as a log, as a function of the subsystem size, where the coefficient in front of the log is related to directly related to the central charge. And these are DMRG results for the entanglement entropy of this ladder for different total sizes. And then here, this shows the subsystem size. And so for the smallest case, this is the entanglement entropy, and then for the larger cases, it looks like that. And then to these arcs, you can fit the formula that I just showed, and from that extract what the central charge is. And our results are consistent with a central charge of 1.5. And these different lines correspond to different bond dimensions, which characterizes the DMRG code. Okay, so
how many? Is that the top at the bottom? How am I supposed to do that? So extending to 1.5?
Yes. So this is increasing the system size. You get more and more consistent with the center charge that we expect.
So that's how close it should be?
There can be all kinds of corrections that depends on the operator content of your theory, and these corrections are only now starting to be understood. So it's difficult to get an estimate from your error, but the nice thing about the central charge is that it can't be anything, right? So in this ballpark, there's only one candidate. So
what is M?
M is the bond dimension. From the number of states that you keep in your DMRG code.
So we achieve more, it seems you are adding more from the center.
Yeah. So I was hoping to go over this quickly enough. So as I said, the square letters is definitely not the square letter is not a textbook example. There seem to be difficult things going on, which we haven't fully understood. Okay, so our sort of intuitive understanding of why this model should be described by a system with central charge 3/2, which is 1 + 1/2, is the following. So you can map a particle sitting on the upper leg. So this is a rung of this square lattice, and if the particle sits on the top side of this rung, then you can denote it as a plus. If it sits on the bottom side, you can denote it as a minus, and if it's empty, you denote it as a zero, and then you can see that the particle configurations take on this form. This is just an example. But that makes it plausible that you can understand this, the C equals one part of this theory as the charge mode, the bosonic mode is the charge mode, and the C equals 1/2 part is the mode related to this this Ising plus minus. And so this picture suggests that we should be able to try and get out just the Ising mode or just the bosonic mode. And so we made an attempt at that, and I'll show you what the result was. So the naive idea would be to change the rung hopping, which would favor or disfavor the formation of singlets on the rung. And so this would be the thing that gaps out the Ising mode. The bosonic modes can be gapped out by breaking translational invariance. So for example, staggering the chemical potential on every other rung. Okay, so we looked at this changing the rung hopping. So I denote a change in the rung hopping by T curve. So T curve being zero means that we have the usual rung hopping as defined by the supersymmetric Hamiltonian. And so there you see that what I've just shown you, that the central charge seems consistent with 1.5. And then if you change this rung hopping away from that value, the central charge that you extract from the DMRG changes. And in particular, if you make it very small, so the effective, the total hopping becomes zero, you flow to a model that has central charge equal to one. But on the other side, you flow to this, zero central charge, which doesn't exist. But so there, it seems that this T-perp opens up a gap. And these different curves are different lengths, and so this is what it looks like for a finite system, but if we could extract the central charge for infinite systems of all these cases, we'd only expect one, then a point with 3/2, and then just a gap.
Is there any reason, understanding why there has to be a cut at the supersymmetric?
Well, I think closer to this critical point, the finite side effects are stronger, and so you get less accurate C. So you should find C equals 1, but it's way less accurate. I think that's the naive.
So you bring supersymmetry by this deformation?
Yes.
Is there a significance to the pattern to the order of the community?
Bela, do you want to answer this question? No. But yeah, okay. We can probably think long about that. Okay, so what we did next is to as I said, on one side, on this side we see a gap opening, right? So there's a gap there, and we can do a scaling of the gap. So there's a formula for finite size gap scaling, and it tells you that if you plot the new gap, so G is T per. In this case, the gap as a function of your perturbing operator minus the original gap times L versus the perturbation times L to the power 2 minus 2h, then you can find a gap collapse, where this 2h is the scaling dimension of your perturbing operator. And so indeed, we find, if we set this 2h to 1.25, we find very nice collapse of the data. And so that suggests that this T perp should be identified with an operator of dimension 5/4. And indeed, such an operator is present in the theory. So it's consistent. The only thing is we haven't really understood this operator yet, but we're working on it. And so a tentative phase diagram is now that we have this C equals 3/2 superconformal field theory where we started at, and then we can perturb away from that, and one direction will flow to C equals 1 plus Ising order, and this Ising order we've actually confirmed computing correlation functions. And in the other direction, you go into the Ising disorder phase, and there will be also charge order in that direction. And now, what would be very nice, but not yet done, is if we would have another axis here where we can gap up the charge order and keep the Ising critical mode. And so a good candidate, as I said, for that would be breaking translational invariance. But our first most naive guess didn't seem to quite work, so we're working on that. But another thing that did seem to work, which we did, was to do a perturbation that preserves supersymmetry. So what you can do is you can... So these were the supercharges, if you remember them from the beginning of the talk. So sum over all sides of the creation operator of the spin is fermions times the projection operator, but now I introduced this lattice-dependent constant. And I can choose them whatever I want. But I'm going to do it in the following way. I'll divide the ladder into two sublattices, S1 and S2. And I pick these guys to be 1 on sublattice S1 and Y on sublattice S2. And this is the choice that I make. So I get this snake-like chain leaving open disconnected sides. And so I'll change the superchargers to have this parameter y on these sides. And the reason we make this choice is that we know when we set y to 0, we're just left with this chain, and that's again the C equals 1, but now the supersymmetric C equals 1. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now the same computation, the central charge is extracted from DMRG. Entanglement entropy computations. And so now the axes are a little bit different. So one is actually here at the bottom. And so this is the familiar point that we know already. And now if we take y towards zero, we indeed see this C equals one theory again. And on the other side, there's again a gap opening up. And for that gap, we did again data collapse, which doesn't look as nice, but still pretty nice. Here we find a different scaling dimension of 1.5, which is also a scaling dimension that's present in the theory. And so the even more speculative phase diagram maybe is that we now have yet this another axis, and we have this super conformal C plus 1 theory when we perturb in one direction and again a gap when we perturb in the other direction. And so, so Bela and I and we have been working on this model for quite some time now, and during the weeks here we have made a lot of progress and which sort of resulted in this, which still has to be confirmed, but I just wanted to show you and also acknowledge some useful conversations that we've had with these people while we were here. Okay, so now let me move back to two dimensions and talk about cohomology. So this is the thing that you need to compute if you really want to know the total number of ground states. So the cohomology of Q, it turns out that there's a one-to-one correspondence between zero energy states and the cohomology element of the cohomology of Q of the supercharged Q. And this computing this cohomology is far more difficult than computing the Witten index, which, as you remember, was just this combinatorial problem. But it also gives a lot more information. So it tells you the total number of zero energy states, and it also tells you the number of particles in each state. And finally, it often gives you some extra information. It gives a sort of a geometric interpretation of your ground states. So,
will you explain us what would be the D operator? What is closed? It's assumed that everybody knows.
No, it's not assumed that everyone knows. It's assumed that no one wants to know. So the D operator is Q itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cohomology of Q is the kernel of Q divided out over the image of Q. And so it's clear that zero energy states are in the kernel of Q, right? They're annihilated by Q. And then it is a little bit more work to show that they will also not be in the image of Q. And then yet a little bit more work to show that linearly independent ground states correspond to different cohomology, different equivalence classes.
That's the case for all possible definitions of Q, or just for specific definitions.
Yeah, I think it's important that at least we need the fact that you can write a complex. So there's the Hilbert space is great. The grade is the number of particles, the Fermion number, and that is something that we definitely use. So I think there are other cues for which this would also work, but I don't think it's guaranteed that it will always work. So for the square lattice, we were actually able to compute the cohomology in the case that we have doubly periodic boundary conditions, so it's on a torus. And what we found is that there's a direct relation between these cohomology elements, and thus zero energy states, and rhombus stylings. So a rhombus styling consists of using these four types of tiles to tile the square lattice, making sure that you have no gaps and no overlaps in these tiles. And then what you find is that for each tiling that you can make on that lattice, there will be a corresponding zero energy state. And the number of tiles in that tiling is equal to the number of fermions in the corresponding zero energy state. And doesn't have periodic boundary conditions.
Is there an intuitive reason? What is the why is this time related to cohomology?
No, I'm afraid. Okay, so the only intuitive picture that I can give is that you can map the tiling to a configuration of particles with the right particle number by putting a particle on each corner. So then you will have one particle per tiling. And as you can see, the edges of these tiles sort of suggest or are such that the particles will be three sides apart. And so that's consistent with the three rule. But if you just look at that configuration that you've then written down, you immediately see that it's not a zero energy state. It's not an eigenstate at all. I mean, particles are way too far apart, so they will hop when you act with the Hamiltonian. And so the actual zero energy state must be something much more complicated than that.
But you have the one-to-one correspondence.
Yes, so the one-to-one correspondence consists of several steps. So you have to first compute the cohomology, and then you have to relate the cohomology to the tilings, and then you have to use the fact that the cohomology has this one-to-one correspondence. But it's a cohomology element is not a zero energy state. Only the harmonic representatives of the cohomology are annihilated by both Q plus and Q minus. And so those would be the actual zero energy states. So computing the cohomology is easier than computing the number of ground states. Now, some consequences of this relation is that so here I've gone back to my notation, but L is the number of sides in the system. So the consequence is that the ground states are at intermediate fillings, and so there will be a zero energy state for each filling between 1/5 and 1/4 filling. And so the ground state at the 5th filling will correspond to only green tiles in your tiling, and the one at a 1/4 filling will have only red tiles. And so you can get anywhere in between by mixing a red and green tiles. And it turns out that you can count these tilings, and that gives you the ground state entropy, which is now sub-extensive. So it's like it goes as a square root of the volume. So it's extensive in the linear size of the system.
So I have a question. So you don't have bosonic ground states?
Yes. So if you agree with this definition that a bosonic state is a many-particle state with an even number of fermions, then there will be lots of bosonic and fermionic states. So in this whole range between a 1/4 and a 5th filling, there will be zero energy states.
But you're not counting them by counting the tiles, right? So.
Yes, I am. Why not?
Because. Okay, so from what I understood, you're counting the number of fermions by the number of tiles.
Oh, but right. So I'm counting the total number of particles in the state. But if this total number of fermions is even, it's a bosonic state. And if the total number of particles is odd, it's a fermionic state.
L is the number of sides.
Yes.
Well, the solid state
Yes, this holds for periodic boundary conditions.
Then, since the substance, can I do local operation on mixed two ground states?
Correct. So okay, this is speculative, of course, but if we really want to think about these tilings as representing the ground states, then to go from one tiling to another, I have to take out a whole row of tiles and put in a new. So you're moving in the right direction. We also thought about this. So one thing that I didn't tell you yet is that if we have open boundary conditions, where we choose the cuts to be along the diagonal directions of the square lattice, there's a unique ground state. And so you lose this huge number of zero energy states. And the question is, of course, where did they go? And since we've only introduced these two cuts, basically, the only available energy scale would be it's inversely proportional to the length of these cuts. And so that suggests that maybe these states are edge states. And this picture tries to illustrate this. So I've drawn two tilings on top of each other. So here they are just the same, but in the gray area, one tiling is denoted by the dashed lines, and that nicely fits the boundary. And the one with the drawn lines makes some error here and here. And so that those would be sort of maybe edge excitations. But as I said, this is quite speculative, but we have some supporting evidence from doing exact diagonalization in ladder geometries, which show critical modes. And so that suggests that by probing a ladder, you maybe probe just the edge physics, and that there's indeed 1+1D criticality observed there. And so the short summary is that the number of ground states grows exponentially in the linear size of the system. These zero energy states sit at intermediate filling. There's evidence for edge modes. And so the question is, of course, now what is the nature of these states? And so as I already explained before, your most naive guess could be to map the tiling into a particle configuration where you put particles on the corners of the sides. But that's way too naive. So this would correspond to some charge density wave, maybe. But you can easily see that this is not at all a zero energy state. So maybe a better guess would be to have particles resonating on and confined to the area of a tile. And so that's a nice picture, but we have not been able to confirm this. But in the last 1 minute, I'll tell you a little bit about some progress that we have been making towards seeing a topological phases in these systems. So what we looked at is the octagon square lattice, this is the also called the bathroom tile, and it's so again, if I have open boundary conditions, there's a unique ground state. And that ground state has one particle per plaquette, per the smaller square, the square. And if I have put this lattice on a torus, then the number of ground states grows again exponentially in the linear size of the system. And now, what we did is we looked at the limit where we do this staggering, which preserves supersymmetry, and so again I introduce these site-dependent constants, which I take one to be on one sublattice and y on the other sublattice, and then if I take y extremely small, very close to zero, then I can understand these different states in terms of topologically protected sectors. I don't have a slide, but I can show you on the board maybe. Is this visible for everyone? Is there a problem here? Okay, so right. So what we're doing is that we take the y to zero on these sides, and what that means is that it will be. So now I'm going to talk about the case where y strictly equal to zero. That's the simplest case. Now, it means that it doesn't cost any energy for the particles to sit on these sides. So we can just, and once particle sits there, there's no way of that particle going anywhere. So the hopping is also zero for the particle. So we can just consider different configurations of these particles on this sublattice, and then look at the rest of the system, whether that has a zero energy state or not. Now, if I take all these sides empty, then the other part of the system is just a collection of chains. And these chains, as we know, they have zero energy states. And we now also know that they're quantum critical, but that we can put that aside for a moment. So if I have a periodic boundary conditions in this direction, the chains have the length of 0.3 in the periodic, so there will be two ground states. So this already justifies one of the two PDMs. So M will now be the number of chains, the number of plaquettes in this direction. Now I can put particles here. But what I see, if I put particle here, then I block sites on the chains because of the nearest neighbor constraint. And so on this lattice, I just cut the chain open, so that's not a problem. But on this side, I have an isolated site. And it turns out that the isolated site has an energy of 1, whether it's empty or occupied. So that's not a zero energy state, so I don't want to do that. So to avoid having an isolated site, I have to also occupy the particle, the site up there. And so I can do that if I have periodic boundary conditions also in this direction. And so it means that for every chain of sites in this direction, I can choose whether to put a chain of particles there or not. And so that gives me another 2 to the n, where n is the number of chains in that direction. And the only thing is now that I counted by this 2 to the n, I also counted the empty state, so I have to subtract the 1. So that gives me the ground state degeneracy there. And now the nice thing is that if I turn on y a little bit, then these particles can start to hop back into these chains. But that will, if this particle hops, I'm going to do this one. If this one disappears and goes into this chain, then I have a problem here that I have again an isolated site. So it does cost me an energy of order 1 for this particle to hop away. So there's a gap of breaking this chain open. And so it in fact it will be cost an infinite action to make the whole chain completely disappear and go into the other into another sector. So that's why we say that different sectors are characterized by the number of particles on these chains, or the particle number of strings, let's say. And that's the topologically protected number in the case that y is very small. Now, whether this survives for y larger, that's a difficult question.
So the width index, is it allowed to jump as a function y?
No. So it can change at y equals 0, but I chose it such that it doesn't happen in this case. Okay, so this is the picture that we started with these two basic states. And now I hope I've showed you that by incorporating supersymmetry, we've been able to say quite a number of nice things about this intermediate density regime. And we had several tools that we could use that really relied on supersymmetry. And we got all kinds of interesting features. And just as a sort of aftermath, just want to remind you of the properties that are present that could allow us to make a connection to holography. So one is that this extensive ground state entropy, and another one is that we have emergent space time supersymmetry as the low energy effect action, at least in 1 plus 1D, but who knows what happens in 2 plus 1D. But maybe we can start in 1 plus 1. And these are these n equals 2 superconformal minimal models.
So the
there seems like some people were, when you say that there's some constraints, that there has to be a single particle and one of these little triangles, they immediately think that you should experiment in terms of the gauge theory. As a Gauss-law constraint. Have you tried to use your exact results to test the idea, that kind of description?
No. So I think that the feeling is like that, but I don't think the particle really constrains to be there. Well, no, it's not. I think it can also fluctuate away.
Even within the grounds, the physical grounds?
Yes.
So, is there any example where this kind of lattice super symmetry becomes the super symmetry in the highest sense when you go along the bracket?
Yeah, so the 1+1 dimensional models have realized the super conformal minimal models, but they have space time super symmetry.
But how do I understand this? So when you look at the lattice model, momentum is not involved in this particle. You don't get the translation from the...
So it's emerging. In the continuum limit, is the full space-time supersymmetry emerges. So it's not something that we put in from the start.
It's not obvious that it should happen necessarily.
No.
So the higher dimension, right?
No, but the model is gapless, right? Because you have all these ground state degeneracy. So there should be massless excitations, and it's translationally invariant.
You don't have to get supersymmetry, though. Yeah. It's quite a different supersymmetry. Like the supersymmetry algebra of this infinity limit is not the same algebra as the
But it survives, right? The point is that you do have that symmetry.
Yeah, the Hamiltonian is an anti-commutator, right?
The Hamiltonian is still the anti-commutator of two operators in the continuum limit.
You double the amount of supersymmetry in the continuum limit, right?
Isn't this? So you already have some, and then you double it.
That's whenever you're on the lattice, you can have exact super cloud as you square to zero. And then if you take a continuum limit, you automatically, for every continuum direction you get, you double the amount of supersymmetry you have.
So you need to emerge some super cloud, which is a spin there rather than a square.
In one dimension, you don't have spin, so it can be more complex.
So that's why you work on it.
Yeah. When people have lattice, they get Enkel's possible limits out of the lattice, you start with one super cloud in quantum mechanics. And that doubles every time you grow in extra dimensions. So by the time you're in four dimensions, you have to have 32 square charges if you have an exact square symmetry in the lattice.
So I just want to say, we don't know that it doesn't work in the one dimension. It's just that we have the same problem as everyone else, that we don't know how to take a continuum limit for this case. So I guess the answer is so
open. Oh, so I wanted to ask about the correspondence between cohomology and timings. It seems that there's some apples and oranges here, because the cohomology, presumably, you don't have a basis, you just have a dimension. So you don't even know what ground state to try to biject to a tiling. Is that correct? The cohomology doesn't come with a preferred basis.
Yeah, so we compute the cohomology in a basis.
Well, I imagine you computed in a basis, but if you're trying to find a correspondence, it would suggest that on the cohomology side, there should be a natural basis. I mean, what you have is you have a Betty number, basically. You just have a dimension of the cohomology.
Yes, yes.
And if you're trying to correspond to tilings, you should have generators in there somehow naturally picked out, even just try to make a bijection.
Yes, that's right. There's no theorem or anything that says that there should be this relation. It's just something that we discovered. But it comes out due to how we compute it.
I mean, what I was thinking is, if you had a guess for a basis in the cohomology side, then you could start playing with things like perhaps the maximum amplitude of particle configurations for a certain basis element was the tiling, you know, the sites of the tiling. But it doesn't seem like you can even try to answer such a question until you know a basis on the cohomology side.
So the momentum is probably a good conserved quantum number in this. Does it commute with the supersymmetry or not? It does. So I can ask, what is the spectrum in each total momentum sector?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that it's a question that has a nice answer, or not really, otherwise you would have told us.
No, sometimes it does have a nice answer. So,
when you come from the time, you can see what momentum they have.
Yeah.
Right? You could see which momentum are included in each time configuration. That's where you come from.
Yeah, in principle, the timing will tell you this.
Thank you so much.